Chapter 8 Sevastopol in the Autumn. If Herbe could have visited Sevastopol as Tolstoy was to do in November 1854, he would have found the town in a state of high alert and feverish activity. In the sweeping opening passage of his Sevastopol sketches, Tolstoy takes us there in the early morning, when the city was bursting into life. On the north side, daytime activity is gradually supplanting the tranquillity of night. Here, with a clatter of muskets, a detachment of sentries is passing by on its way to relieve the guard. Here, a private, having clambered from his dugout and washed his bronzed face in icy water, is turning towards the reddening east, rapidly crossing himself and saying his prayers. Here, a tall, heavy madjara, drawn by camels, is creaking its way towards the cemetery, where the bloody corpses with which it is piled almost to the brim will be buried. As you approach the quay, you are struck by the distinctive smells of coal, beef, manure and damp. Thousands of oddly assorted articles, firewood, sides of meat, gabions, sacks of flour, iron bars and the like, lie piled up near the quayside. Soldiers of various regiments, some with kit bags and muskets, others without, are milling around here, smoking, shouting abuse at one another, or dragging heavy loads onto the ship that is lying at anchor, smoke coming from its funnel by the landing stage. Civilian skiffs filled with a most various assortment of people, soldiers, sailors, merchants, women, are constantly mooring and casting off along the waterfront. The quayside contains a noisy jostle of soldiers in grey, sailors in black, and women in all sorts of colours. Peasant women are selling rolls. Russian mujiks with samovars are shouting, "Hotsbiten!" And right here, lying about on the very first steps of the landing, are rusty cannonballs, shells, grape shot, and cast-iron cannon of various calibres. A little further off, there is a large open area strewn with enormous squared beams, gun carriages, and the forms of sleeping soldiers. There are horses, wagons, green field guns with ammunition boxes, infantry muskets stacked in criss-cross piles. A constant movement persists of soldiers, sailors, officers, merchants, women and children. Carts laden with hay, sacks or barrels come and go, and here and there a Cossack or an officer is passing by on horseback, or a general in his droshky. To the right, the street is blocked by a barricade, the embrasures of which are mounted with a small cannon. Beside them sits a sailor, puffing at his pipe. To the left is a handsome building with Roman numerals carved on its pediment, beneath which soldiers are standing with blood-stained stretchers. Everywhere you perceive the unpleasant signs of a military encampment. Sevastopol was a military town. Its entire population of 40,000 people was connected in some way to the life of the naval base, whose garrison numbered about 18,000 men, and from that unity Sevastopol gained its military strength. There were sailors who had lived there with their families since Sevastopol's foundation in the 1780s. Socially, the city had a singularity. Frock coats were rarely to be seen among the naval uniforms on its central boulevards. There were no great museums, galleries, concert halls, or intellectual treasures in Sevastopol. The imposing neoclassical buildings of the city centre were all military in character. The Admiralty, the Naval School, the Arsenal, the garrisons, the ship repair workshops, the army stores and warehouses, the military hospital and the officers' library, one of the richest in Europe. Even the Assembly of Nobles, the handsome building with Roman numerals, turned into a hospital during the siege. The town was divided into two distinct parts, a north and a south side, separated from each other by the sea harbour, and the only direct means of communication between the two was by boat. The north side of the town was a world apart from the elegant neoclassical facades around the military harbour on the southern side. It had few built-up streets, and fishermen and sailors lived there in a semi-rural style, growing vegetables and keeping livestock in the gardens of their dachas. On the south side, there was another, less obvious distinction between the administrative centre on the western side of the military harbour and the naval dockyards on the eastern side, where the sailors lived in garrisons or with their families in small wooden houses no more than a few yards from the defensive works. Women hung their washing on lines thrown between their houses and the fortress walls and bastions. Like Tolstoy, visitors to Sevastopol were always struck by the strange intermingling of camp and town life, of handsome town and dirty bivouac. Yevgeny Yershov, a young artillery officer who arrived in Sevastopol that autumn, was impressed by the way the people of the city went about their ordinary everyday business amid all the chaos of the siege. "It was strange," he wrote, "to see how people carried on with their normal lives. A young woman quietly out walking with her pram, traders buying and selling, children running round and playing in the streets, while all around them was a battlefield, and they might be killed at any time." People lived as if there was no tomorrow in the weeks prior to the invasion. There was non-stop revelry, heavy drinking and gambling, while the city's many prostitutes worked overtime. The Allied landings had a sobering effect, but confidence ran high among the junior officers, who all assumed that the Russian army would defeat the British and the French. They drank toasts to the memory of 1812. "The mood among us was one of high excitement," recalled Mikhail Botanov, a young sea cadet, "and we were not frightened of the enemy. The only one among us who did not share our confidence was the commander of a steamship, who, unlike us, had often been abroad and liked to say the proverb, 'In anger is not strength.' Events were to show that he was longer sighted and better informed about the true state of affairs than we were." The defeat of the Russian forces at the Alma created panic among the civilian population of Sevastopol. People were expecting the Allies to invade from the north at any time. They were confused when they saw their fleets on the southern side, supposing wrongly that they had been surrounded. "I don't know anyone who at that moment did not say a prayer," recalled one inhabitant. "We all thought the enemy about to break through." Captain Nikolai Lipkin, a battery commander in the 4th Bastion, wrote to his brother in St. Petersburg at the end of September, "Many inhabitants have already left, but we, the servicemen, are staying here to teach a lesson to our uninvited guests. For 3 days in a row, 24th, 25th and 26th of September, there were religious processions through the towns and all the batteries. It was humbling to see how our fighters, standing by their bivouacs, bowed before the cross and the icons carried by our womenfolk. The churches have been emptied of their treasures. I say it was not needed, but people do not listen to me now. They are all afraid. Any moment now we are expecting a general attack, both by land and sea. So, my brother, that's how things are here. And what will happen next, only the Lord knows." Despite Lipkin's confidence, the Russian commanders were seriously considering abandoning Sevastopol after the battle at the Alma. There were then 8 steamers on the northern side waiting for the order to evacuate the troops and 10 warships on the southern side to cover their escape. Many of the city's residents made their own getaway as the enemy approached, though their path was blocked by Russian troops. Water supplies in the city were running dangerously low, the fountains having stopped and the whole population being dependent on the wells, which were always short of water at this time of year. Told by deserters that the city was supplied by water springs and pipes that ran down a ravine from the heights where they were camped, the British and the French had cut off this supply, leaving Sevastopol with just the aqueduct that supplied the naval dockyard. As the Allies set up camp and prepared their bombardment of the town, the Russians worked around the clock to strengthen its defences on the southern side. With Menshikov nowhere to be seen, the main responsibility for the defence of Sevastopol passed into the hands of 3 commanders. Admiral Kornilov, Chief of Staff of the Black Sea Fleet, Totleben, the engineer, and Nachimov, the hero of Sinope and commander of the port, who was popular among the sailors and seen as one of them. All three men were military professionals of a new type that contrasted strongly with the courtier Menshikov. Their energy was remarkable. Kornilov was everywhere, inspiring the people by his daily presence in every sector of the defensive works, and promising rewards to everyone if they could only keep the town. Tolstoy, who was to join Lipkin as a battery commander in the Fourth Bastion, wrote a letter to his brother the day after he arrived, in which he described Kornilov on his rounds. Instead of hailing the men with the customary greeting, "Health to you," the admiral called to them, "If you must die, lads, will you die?" And, Tolstoy wrote, the men shouted, "We will die, Your Excellency! Hurrah!" And they do not say it for effect, for in every face I saw not jesting but earnestness. Kornilov himself was far from certain that this city could be saved. On the 27th of September he wrote to his wife, "We have only 5,000 reserves and 10,000 sailors, armed with various weaponry, even pikes. Not much of a garrison to defend a fortress whose defences are stretched over many miles and broken up so much that there is no direct communication between them. But what will be, will be. We have resolved to make a stand. It will be a miracle if we hold out. And if not..." His uncertainty was increased when the sailors discovered a large supply of vodka on the wharf and went on a drunken rampage for 3 days. It was left to Kornilov to destroy the supplies of liquor and sober up his sailors for battle. The defensive preparations were frenzied and improvised. When the work began, it was discovered that there were no shovels in Sevastopol, so men were sent to procure as many as they could from Odessa. 3 weeks later, they returned with 400 spades. Meanwhile, the people of the city worked in the main with wooden shovels they had made from torn-up planks of wood. The whole population of Sevastopol, sailors, soldiers, prisoners of war, working men and women, including prostitutes, was involved in digging trenches, carting earth to the defences, building walls and barricades, and constructing batteries with earth fascines and gabions, while teams of sailors hauled up the heavy guns they had taken from their ships. Every means of carrying the earth was commandeered, and when there were no baskets, bags or buckets, the diggers carried it in their folded clothes. The expectation of an imminent attack added greater urgency to their work. Inspecting these defences a year later, the Allies were amazed by the skill and ingenuity of the Russians. Informed of these heroic efforts by the people of Sevastopol, the Tsar wrote to General Korchakov at the end of September, reminding him of the special Russian spirit that had saved the country from Napoleon, and urging him to summon it again against the British and the French. "We shall pray to God that you may call on them to save Sevastopol, the fleet, and the Russian land. Do not bow to anyone," he underlined in his own hand. "Show the world that we are the same Russians who stood firm in 1812. The Tsar also wrote to Menshikov, at that time near the river Belbek, northeast of Sevastopol, with a message for the people of the town. "Tell our young sailors that all my hopes are invested in them. Tell them not to bow to anyone, to put their faith in God's mercy, to remember that we are Russians, that we are defending our homeland and our faith, and to submit humbly to the will of God. May God preserve you. My prayers are all for you and for our holy cause." Meanwhile, the Allies embarked on their lengthy preparations for the siege. Raglan had wanted an immediate assault. He had seen the weakness of the Russian defences and was encouraged by the forthright and masterful Sir George Cathcart in command of the 4th Division, whose troops had taken up positions on a hill from which he could see the whole town. It was from there that he wrote to Raglan, "If you and Sir John Burgoyne would pay me a visit, you can see everything in the way of defences, which is not much. They're working at 2 or 3 redoubts, but the place is only enclosed by a thing like a loose park wall, not in good repair. I'm sure I could walk into it with scarcely the loss of a man at night or an hour before daybreak, if all the rest of the force was up between the sea and the hill I am upon. We would leave our packs and run into it, even in open day, only risking a few shots whilst we passed the redoubts. Burgoyne, formerly an advocate of a quick assault, now disagreed. Concerned with loss of lives, the army's chief engineer insisted on the need to subdue the enemy's fire with siege guns before an assault by troops was launched. The French agreed with him, so the Allies settled down to the slow process of landing siege artillery and hauling it up to the heights. There were endless problems with the British guns, many of which had to be dismantled before they could be unloaded from the ships. "The placing of our heavy ship guns in position has been most tedious," Captain William Cameron of the Grenadier Guards wrote to his father. "The ship guns have to be taken all to pieces, as the carriages, having only small rollers as wheels, cannot be moved along by themselves, whereas the regular siege guns can be wheeled into their places as they stand. We have just completed a battery of 5 68-pound guns of 9,500 weight each, all ship's guns, which will tell more than any battery ever heard of at a siege before. The ground is dreadfully rocky, so that a great part of the earth for the parapet has to be carried." It was 18 days before the guns were finally in place, days that gave the Russians crucial time to prepare their defences. While the British were hauling up their guns, the French took the lead in digging trenches, moving slowly forward in a zigzag formation towards the defences of Sevastopol as the Russians fired at them with artillery. The opening of the first trench was the most dangerous because there was little protection from the Russian guns. Armed with shovels and pickaxes, the first shift of 800 men crept forward under cover of the night, using rocks for shelter, until they reached a point within a kilometre of Sevastopol's Flagstaff Bastion, and on lines marked out by their commanders, began digging themselves into the ground, piling up the soil in gabions in front of them to protect themselves from the Russians. On that night, the 9th to 10th of October, the sky was clear and the moon was out, but a northwest wind took the sound of digging away from the town, and by dawn, when the sleepy Russians at last discovered them, the French had dug a protected trench 1,000 metres long. Under heavy bombardment, 3,000 French soldiers went on with the works, digging new entrenchments every night and repairing the trenches damaged by the Russians the next day, while shells and mortar whistled past their heads. By the 16th of October, the first 5 French batteries had been built with sacks of earth and wood for palisades, fortified breastworks and parapets, and more than 50 guns, cannon, mortars and howitzers, mounted on raised platforms on the ground. Following the French, the British dug entrenchments and sited their first batteries on Green Hill, the left attack, and Vorontsov Hill, the right attack, the two positions separated by a deep ravine. Shifts of 500 men on each attack worked day and night, while more than twice that number guarded them from the Russians, who launched sorties at night. "I am off duty this morning at 4 a.m. after 24 hours in the trenches," Captain Radcliffe of the 20th Regiment wrote to his family. "When we got under the breastwork that had been thrown up in the night, we were pretty well under cover, but were obliged to lie down all the time, for this, of course, was the target of the enemy's artillery day and night, and the trench was only half made. However, a few men were placed on the lookout, their heads a few inches above the work, to give notice when they fired, by watching the smoke from the guns by day and the flash by night, and calling out, 'Shot!' when all in the trenches lie down and get under cover of the breastwork till it has passed, and then resume their work. By attending to this, we only lost one man during the day. He was killed by a round shot." On the 16th of October, it was finally decided to begin the bombardment of Sevastopol the following morning, even though the British works were not quite completed. There was a mood of optimistic expectation in the Allied camp. "All artillery officers, French, English, and naval, say that after a fire of 48 hours, little will be seen of Sevastopol but a heap of ruins," wrote Henry Clifford, a staff officer in the Light Division, to his family. A According to Evelyn Wood, a midshipman who had watched the Battle of the Alma from the top mast of his ship before being transferred to the land attack with the naval brigade, on the 16th of October, the betting in our camp was long odds that the fortress would fall in a few hours. Some of the older and more prudent officers estimated that the Russians might hold out for 48 hours, but this was the extreme opinion. A soldier offered me a watch, Paris-made, which he had taken off a Russian soldier killed at the Alma, for which he asked 20 shillings. My messmates would not allow me to buy it, saying that gold watches would be cheaper in 48 hours. At dawn on the 17th of October, as soon as the fog had cleared, the Russians saw that the embrasures of the enemy batteries had been opened. Without waiting for the enemy guns to open fire, the Russians began shelling them along the line, and soon afterwards the Allied counter-bombardment began with 72 British and 53 French guns. Within a few minutes, the gun battle was at its height. The booming of the guns, the roaring and the whistling of the shot, and the deafening explosions of the shell drowned out the calls of the bugles and the drums. Sevastopol was completely lost in a thick black pall of smoke which hung over the whole darkened battlefield, making it impossible for the Allied gunners to hit their target with any military precision. "We could only sit and guess and hope we were doing well," wrote Calthorpe, who watched the bombardment with Raglan from the quarries on Vorontsov Hill. For thousands of civilians sheltering in the bombed-out ruins of their homes in Sevastopol, these were the most terrifying moments of their lives. "I never saw or heard of anything like it before," wrote one resident. "For 12 hours, the wild howling of the bombs was unbroken. It was impossible to distinguish between them, and the ground shook beneath our feet. A thick smoke filled the sky and blotted out the sun. It became as dark as night. Even the rooms were filled with smoke." As soon as the bombardment had begun, Kornilov had set off with his flag lieutenant, Prince V.I. Baryatinsky, to make a tour of the defences. They went first to the 4th Bastion, the most dangerous place in Sevastopol, which was being shelled by both the British and the French. "Inside the number 4 Bastion," recalled Baryatinsky, "the scene was frightful and the destruction enormous, whole gun teams having been struck down by shellfire. The wounded and dead were being removed by stretcher-bearers, but they were still lying round in heaps." Kornilov went to every gun, encouraging the crews, and then moved on to the 5th Bastion, under no less pressure from the enemy's artillery, where he met Nachimov, dressed as he always was in a frock coat with epaulets. Nachimov had been wounded in the face, though he did not seem to notice it, Baryatinsky thought, as blood ran down his neck, staining the white ribbon of his St. George cross as he talked with Kornilov. While they were conversing there, Baryatinsky recognized an officer approaching, though he had no eyes or face, for his features had completely disappeared underneath a mass of bloody flesh. The remains of a sailor who had been blown up, which the officer proceeded to wipe from his face while he asked Baryatinsky for a cigarette. Ignoring the advice of his staff, who said it was too dangerous to go on, Kornilov continued his tour at the 3rd Bastion, the Redan, which was then being pounded by the heavy British guns with a deadly concentration of power. When Kornilov arrived, the bastion was under the command of Captain Popandoul, but he was soon killed, as were the 5 other commanders who succeeded him that day. Kornilov passed through the trench system within close range of the British guns, crossed the ravine, and climbed up to the Malakhov Bastion, where he talked to the wounded troops. He was just starting down the hill to complete his tour in the Ushakov Ravine when he was hit by a shell that blew away the lower part of his body. Taken to the military hospital, he died shortly afterwards. Towards midday, the Allied fleet joined in the bombardment, directing their heavy guns towards Sevastopol from an arc around the entrance to the sea harbour, some 800 to 1,500 metres from the coast. The blockade of the harbour by the sunken Russian ships stopped them getting any closer to their target. For 6 hours, the city was shelled by an Allied broadside of 1,240 guns. Its coastal batteries had just 150 guns. The sight was one of the most awful in the way of guns, Henry James, a merchant seaman, wrote in his diary after watching the bombardment from further out to sea. Several of the liners kept up a heavy cannonade, and it could be compared to the rolling of a huge drum. We could see showers of shot striking the water at the foot of the forts and flying up in heaps at the walls. The firing of the fleets created so much smoke that the Russian gunners could not even see the ships. Some of the gunners lost their nerve, but others showed extraordinary bravery, firing at the gun flashes of the invisible ships while shells crashed around their heads. One artillery officer on the 10th Bastion, the main focus of the French attack, recalled seeing men who had been rewarded for their courage in previous engagements running off in panic when the firing began.
"I was caught myself between two feelings," he recalled. "One half of me wanted to run home to save my family, but my sense of duty told me I should stay. My feelings as a man got the better of the soldier within me, and I ran away to find my family."
In fact, for all their guns, the French and British ships received better than they gave. The wooden sailing vessels of the Allied fleet were unable to get close enough to the stone forts of the coastal bastions to cause them much damage. The blockade had done its job in this respect. But they could be set alight by the Russian guns, which were not so numerous, but, because they were based on the land, much more accurate than the Allies' long-range cannonade. After firing an estimated 50,000 rounds to little real effect on the coastal batteries, the Allied fleet weighed anchor and sailed away to count its losses. 5 ships badly damaged, 30 sailors killed, and more than 500 men wounded. Without steam-powered iron ships, the Allied fleet was destined to play only a subsidiary role to the army during the siege of Sevastopol. The first day's outcome on the land was not much more encouraging for the Allies. The French made little headway against Mount Rodolphe before one of their main magazines was blown up and they ceased fire, and while the British caused considerable damage to the third bastion, accounting for most of the 1,100 Russian casualties, they had lacked the heavy mortars to make their superior firepower count. Their much-vaunted new weapon, the 68-pounder Lancaster gun, was unreliable firing shells and was ineffective at long range against Russian earthworks, which absorbed the light projectiles.
"I fear the Lancaster is a failure," reported Captain Lushington to General Airy the next day. "Our guns do not go far enough out, and we injure our own embrasures more than the enemy. I have impressed on all the officers the necessity of slow and steady firing, but the distances are too great, and we might as well fire into a pudding as at these earthworks."
The failure of the first day's bombardment was a rude awakening for the Allies. "The town appears built of incombustible materials," wrote Fanny Duberly, who had come to the Crimea as a war tourist with her husband, Henry Duberly, paymaster of the 8th Hussars. "Although it was twice slightly on fire yesterday, the flames were almost immediately extinguished." On the Russian side, the first day had destroyed the mystique of the Allied armies established by their victory at the Alma. Suddenly, the enemy was no longer seen as invincible, and from that, the Russians gained new hope and self-confidence.
"We all thought it was impossible for our batteries to save us," a resident of Sevastopol wrote in a letter the next day. "So imagine our surprise when today we found all our batteries intact and all the guns in place. God has blessed Russia and rewarded us for the insults we have suffered to our faith."
Having survived the first day's bombardment, the Russians now resolved to break the siege by attacking Balaclava and cutting off the British from their main base of supplies. After Alma, Menshikov had set out towards Bakhchisarai. Now, with the change in strategy, he amassed his troops in the Chernaya Valley on Sevastopol's eastern side, where they were joined by the first reinforcements to arrive from the Danubian front, the 12th Infantry Division, under the command of Lieutenant General Pavel Liprandi. On the evening of the 24th of October,
a field army of 60,000 troops, 34 squadrons of cavalry, and 78 artillery pieces camped around the village of Chorgun on Fedyukin Heights for an attack on the British defences of Balaclava the following morning. The objective was well chosen, as the British were themselves aware they were seriously overstretched and there was not much to protect their supply base from a swift attack by a large force of men. The British had constructed a total of 6 small redoubts along part of the Causeway Heights, the ridge line of the Vorontsov Road, separating the northern half of the Balaclava Valley between the Fedyukin Heights and the road from the southern half between the road and the port itself, and placed in each of the 4 completed redoubts a Turkish guard, consisting mainly of raw recruits, with 2 or 3 12-pounder guns of position. Behind the redoubts in the southern half of the valley, the British had positioned the 93rd Highland Infantry Brigade, under the command of Sir Colin Campbell, to whom the defence of the port was entrusted, while encamped on their flank was the cavalry division of Lord Lucan, and on the heights above the gorge descending to the port, 1,000 Royal Marines with some field artillery. In the event of an attack by the Russians, Campbell could also rely on the support of the British infantry, as well as 2 divisions of French troops under General Bosquet encamped on the heights above Sevastopol. But until they arrived, the defence of Balaclava would depend on 5,000 troops. At daybreak on the 25th of October, the Russians commenced their attack. Establishing a field battery close to the village of Kamara, they began a heavy bombardment of the No. 1 redoubt on Canrobert's Hill, named by the British in honour of the French commander. During the night, Raglan had been warned of the imminent attack by a deserter from the Russian camp, but having sent 1,000 men to Balaclava in response to a false alarm only 3 days previously, he decided not to act, yet another blunder to put against his name. Though he did reach the Sapun Heights in time to get a grandstand view of the fighting in the valley below him after messages were sent to his headquarters at the start of the attack. For more than an hour, the 500 Turkish troops defending the No. 1 redoubt put up a stubborn resistance, as they had done against the Russians at Silistria, losing more than 1/3 of their men. But then, 1,200 Russian troops stormed the redoubt at the point of the bayonet, forcing the exhausted defenders to abandon it to them, along with 3 of the 7 British cannon which had been lent to the Turks. "To our disgust," recalled Calthorpe, who was watching from the Sapun Heights with Raglan's staff, "we saw a little stream of men issue from the rear of the redoubt and run down the hillside towards our lines. Seeing their countrymen in full retreat, the Turkish garrisons in the neighbouring 3 redoubts, 2, 3, and 4, followed their example and withdrew towards the port, many of them carrying their blankets, pots, and pans, and crying, 'Ship! Ship!' as they passed the British lines." Calthorpe watched as 1,000 Turkish troops streamed down the hill, pursued by large parties of Cossacks. "The yells of these wild horsemen could be heard from where we were as they galloped after these unhappy Muslims, numbers of whom were killed by their lances." As they ran through the settlement of Kadikoy, the Turkish soldiers were jeered at by a group of British army wives, including one, a massive washerwoman with brawny arms and hands as hard as horn, who seized hold of a Turk and gave him a good kicking for trampling on the washing she had laid out in the sun to dry. When she realised that the Turks had deserted her own husband's regiment, the 93rd, she scolded them. "Ye cowardly misbelievers, to leave the brave Christian Highlanders to fecht when ye ran away!" The Turks tried to placate her, and some called her Kokana, prompting her to become even more enraged. "Kokana indeed, I'll Kokana ye," she cried, and brandishing a stick, chased them down the hill. Tired and downcast, the Turkish soldiers continued their retreat until they reached the ravine leading to the port. Throwing their belongings on the ground, they lay down beside them to get some rest. Some spread out their prayer mats on the ground and said a prayer towards Mecca. The British accused the Turkish troops of cowardice, but this was unfair. According to John Blunt, Lord Lucan's Turkish interpreter, Most of the troops were Tunisians without proper training or experience of war. They had only just arrived in the Crimea and were in a famished state. None of them had received any rations they could eat as Muslims since they had left Varna several days before, and on their arrival they had disgraced themselves by attacking civilians. Blunt rode after the retreating troops and relayed to an officer Lucan's command for them to regroup behind the 93rd, but he was accosted by the soldiers, who appeared parched with thirst and exhausted. They asked him why no British troops had come to their support, complained that they had been left in the redoubts for several days without food or water, and declared that the ammunition they were supplied with did not fit in the guns in the redoubts. One of the soldiers, his head in a bandage and smoking a long pipe, said to Blunt in Turkish, "What can we do, sir? It is God's will." The Russian infantry took redoubts 1, 2, 3 and 4 on the Causeway Heights, abandoning the 4th after they had destroyed the gun carriages. The Russian cavalry under General Rzhov moved up behind them along the North Valley and turned to attack the 93rd, the only infantry force that now prevented them from breaking through to Balaclava, since the British cavalry had been withdrawn to await the arrival of infantry from the plateau above Sevastopol. Descending from the Causeway Heights, 4 squadrons of Rzhov's cavalry, some 400 men, charged towards the Highlanders. Watching the scene from a vineyard near the camp of the Light Brigade, Fanny Dubeley was horrified. Shots began to fly, and presently came the Russian cavalry charging over the hillside and across the valley, right against the little line of Highlanders. Ah, what a moment! Charging and surging onward, what could that little wall of men do against such numbers and such speed? There they stood. Forming his men into a line just 2 deep instead of the usual square employed by infantry against the cavalry, Campbell placed his trust in the deadly rifle power of the Minier, whose effects he had seen at the Alma. As the cavalry approached, he rode along the line, calling on his men to stand firm and die there, according to Lieutenant Colonel Sterling of the 93rd, who thought he looked as if he meant it. To Russell of the Times, watching from the heights, they looked like a thin red streak tipped with a line of steel, later and forever misquoted as a thin red line. The appearance of a steady line of redcoats caused the Russian cavalry to hesitate, and as they did so, at a range of about 1,000 metres, Campbell gave the order for the first volley. When the smoke had cleared, Sergeant Munro of the 93rd saw that the cavalry were still advancing straight for the line. A second volley rang forth, and then we observed that there was a little confusion in the enemy's ranks and that they were swerving to our right. A third volley at much closer range caught the Russians in the flank, causing them to bend sharply to their left and ride back to their own army. Rzhov's first 4 squadrons had been repulsed, but the main body of the Russian cavalry, 2,000 hussars, flanked by Cossack outriders, now descended from the Causeway Heights for a second charge against the Highlanders. This time, the infantry was rescued just in time by the intervention of the British cavalry, 8 squadrons of the Heavy Brigade, some 700 men, who had been ordered to return to the South Valley to support the 93rd by Raglan, who, from his position on the Sapun Heights, had seen the danger the Highlanders were in. Riding slowly up the hill towards the enemy, the Heavy moved across their column, dressed their lines, and then, from 100 metres, charged right into them, slashing wildly at them with their swords. The advance riders of the British cavalry, the Scots Greys and Inniskillings, 6th Dragoons, were completely enveloped by the Russians, who had briefly halted to extend their ranks just before the charge. But the red jackets of the 4th and 5th Dragoons soon piled into the melee, cutting at the Russian flanks and rear. The opposing horsemen were so tightly packed together that there was no room for swordsmanship. They could barely raise their swords or swing their sabres, and all they could do was hit or cut at anything within their reach, as if they were in a brawl. Sergeant Major Henry Franks of the 5th Dragoons saw Private Harry Herbert attacked by 3 Cossacks at the same time. He disabled one of them by a terrible cut across the back of the neck, and the second one scampered off. Herbert made a point at the third man's breast, but his sword blade broke off about 3 inches from the hilt. He threw the heavy sword hilt at the Russian, which hit him dead in the face, and the Cossack dropped to the ground. He was not dead, but it spoiled his visage. Major William Forrest of the 4th Dragoons recalled his frenzied fight with a hussar who cut at my head, but the brass pot stood well, and my head is only slightly bruised. I cut again at him, but I do not believe that I hurt him more than he hurt me. I received a blow on the shoulder at the same time, which was given by some other man, but the edge must have been very badly delivered, for it has only cut my coat and slightly bruised my shoulder. There were surprisingly few casualties, no more than 12 killed on either side, and 300 or so wounded, mostly on the Russian side, though the combat lasted less than 10 minutes. The Russians' heavy greatcoats and thick shakos protected them from most sabre cuts, while their own swords were just as ineffective against the longer reach of the British cavalrymen, who sat on taller and heavier mounts. In this sort of fighting, one side must eventually give way. It was the Russians who lost their nerve first. Shaken by the fighting, the hussars turned away and galloped back to the North Valley, pursued by the British cavalry, until they withdrew under fire from the Russian batteries on the causeway and the Fedyukin Heights. While the Russian cavalry withdrew, the British infantry descended from the heights of Sevastopol and marched across the South Valley to support the 93rd. The 1st Division arrived first, followed by the 4th, and then French reinforcements too. The 1st Division and 2 squadrons of Chasseurs d'Afrique. With the arrival of the Allied infantry, it was not likely that the Russian cavalry would attack again. Balaclava had been saved. As the Russians cut their losses and moved back to their base, Raglan and his staff on the Sapun Heights noticed them removing the British guns from the redoubts. The Duke of Wellington had never lost a gun, or so it was believed by the keepers of his cult in the British military establishment. The prospect of these guns being paraded as trophies in Sevastopol was unbearable for Raglan, who at once sent an order to Lord Lucan, the commander of the cavalry division, to recover the Causeway Heights, assuring him of the support of the infantry that had just arrived. Lucan could not see the infantry, and could not believe that he was meant to act alone with just the cavalry against infantry and artillery, so for 3/4 of an hour he did nothing, while Raglan on the hill became more alarmed about the fate of the captured British guns. Eventually, he dictated a second order to Lucan. "Lord Raglan wishes the cavalry to advance rapidly to the front. Follow the enemy and try to prevent the enemy carrying away the guns. Troop horse artillery may accompany. French cavalry is on your left. Immediate." The order was not just unclear, it was absurd, and Lucan was completely at a loss as to what to make of it. From where he was standing at the western end of the Causeway Heights, he could see, to his right, the British guns in the redoubts, captured by the Russians from the Turks. To his left, at the end of the North Valley, where he knew the bulk of the Russian forces were located, he could see a second set of guns, and further to the left, on the lower slopes of the Fedyukin Heights, he could see that the Russians also had a battery of artillery. If Raglan's order had been clearer and specified that it was the British guns on the Causeway Heights that Lucan was to take, the charge of the Light Brigade would have ended very differently. But as it was, the order left unclear which guns the cavalry was to recover. The only man who could tell him what it meant was the aide-de-camp who delivered it, Captain Nolan of the King's Hussars. Like many cavalrymen in the Light Brigade, Nolan had become increasingly frustrated by Lucan's failure to employ the cavalry in the sort of bold attack for which it had earned its reputation as the greatest in the world. At the Bulganak and the Alma, the cavalry had been stopped from pursuing the Russians in retreat. On the Mackenzie Heights, during the march to Balaclava, Lucan had prevented an attack on the Russian army marching east across their path, and only that morning, when the heavy brigade was outnumbered by the Russian cavalry only a few minutes' ride away, Lord Cardigan, the Light Brigade's commander, declined to use them for a swift assault upon the routed enemy. The Light Brigade were made to watch while their comrades fought with the same Cossacks who had jeered at them at the Bulganak for refusing to fight. One of their officers had several times demanded of Lord Cardigan to send in the brigade, and when Cardigan refused, slapped his saluting sword against his leg in a show of disrespect. There were signs of disobedience. Private John Doyle of the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars recalled, "The light brigade were not well pleased when they saw the heavy brigade and were not let go to their assistance. They stood up in their stirrups and shouted, 'Why are we kept here?' and at the same moment broke up and dashed back through our lines for the purpose of following the Russian retreat, but they had got too far for us to overtake them." So when Lucan asked Nolan what Raglan's order meant, there was a threat of insubordination in the air. In the account he later gave in a letter to Raglan, Lucan asked the aide-de-camp where he should attack, and Nolan had replied, "In a most disrespectful but significant manner," pointing to the further end of the valley. "There, my lord, is your enemy. There are your guns." According to Lucan, Nolan had not pointed to the British guns on the Causeway Heights, but towards the battery of 12 Russian cannon and the main force of the Cossack cavalry at the far end of the North Valley, on either side of which, on the Causeway and Fedyukin Heights, the Russians had more cannon as well as riflemen. Lucan took the order to Cardigan, who pointed out the lunacy of charging down a valley against artillery and musket fire on three sides, but Lucan insisted that the order be obeyed. Cardigan and Lucan, who were brothers-in-law, detested each other. This is usually the explanation given by historians as to why they failed to consult and find a way to circumvent the order they believed they had been given by Raglan. It would not be the first time that Raglan's orders had been disobeyed. But there is also evidence that Lucan was afraid to disobey an order that was in fact welcomed by the men of the Light Brigade, eager for action against the Russian cavalry and in danger of losing discipline if they were prevented from attacking them. Lucan himself later wrote to Raglan that he had obeyed the order because not to do so would have exposed me and the cavalry to aspersions against which we might have difficulty in defending ourselves, by which he surely meant aspersions from his men and the rest of the army. The 661 men of the Light Brigade advanced at a walk down the gently sloping North Valley. The 13th Light Dragoons and 17th Lancers in the first line, led by Cardigan, the 11th Hussars immediately behind, followed by the 8th Hussars together with the 4th, Queen's Own Regiment of Light Dragoons. It was 2,000 metres to the enemy's position at the end of the valley, and at regulation speeds it would take the Light Brigade about 7 minutes to cover the distance. Artillery and musket fire to the right of them, to the left of them, and in front of them along the way. As the first line broke into a trot, Nolan, who was riding with the 17th Lancers, galloped forward, waving his sword and, according to most versions, shouting to the men to hurry them along. Although it has also been suggested that he realised the mistake and was attempting to redirect the Light Brigade towards the Causeway Heights and perhaps beyond to the South Valley, where they would be safe from the Russian guns. Either way, the first shell fired by the Russians exploded over Nolan and killed him. Whether it was Nolan's example, their own eagerness, or because they wanted to get through the flanking fire as fast as possible remains unclear, but the two regiments at the head of the charge broke into a gallop long before they were ordered to. "Come on!" shouted one man from the 13th Light Dragoons. "Don't let those bastards, the 17th Lancers, get ahead of us!" As they galloped through the crossfire from the hills, cannonballs tearing the earth up and musket fire raining in like hail, men were shot and horses fell. "The reports from the guns and the bursting of shells were deafening," recalled Sergeant Bond of the 11th Hussars. "The smoke, too, was almost blinding. Horses and men were falling in every direction, and the horses that were not hurt were so upset that we could not keep them in a straight line for a time. A man named Allred, who was riding on my left, fell from his horse like a stone. I looked back and saw the poor fellow lying on his back, his right temple being cut away and his brain partly on the ground." Trooper Whiteman of the 17th Lancers saw his sergeant hit. "He had his head carried clean off by a round shot. yet for about 30 yards further, the headless body kept in the saddle, the lance at the charge, firmly gripped under the right arm. So many men and horses from the first line were shot down that the second line, 100 meters behind, had to swerve and slow down to avoid the wounded bodies on the ground and the bewildered, frightened horses that galloped without riders in every direction. Within a few minutes, those that remained of the first line were in among the Russian gunners at the end of the valley. Cardigan, whose horse flinched from the gun's last salvo at close range, was said to be the first man through. "The flame, the smoke, the roar were in our faces," recalled Corporal Thomas Morley of the 17th Lancers, who compared it to riding into the mouth of a volcano. Cutting down the gunners with their swords, the Light Brigade charged on with their sabres drawn to attack the Cossacks, who were ordered forward by Rychov to protect the guns, which some of the attackers were attempting to wheel away. Without time to form themselves before they were attacked, the Cossacks were thrown into a panic by the disciplined order of the mass of cavalry bearing down on them, recalled a Russian officer. They turned sharply to escape, and, seeing that their way was blocked by the Hussar regiment, began to fire their muskets point-blank at their own comrades, who fell back in panic, turned and charged into the other regiments behind. The whole of the Russian cavalry began a stampede towards Chorgun, some dragging the mounted guns behind them, while the advance riders of the Light Brigade, outnumbered 5-1, pursued them all the way to the Chernaya River. The panic flight of the Russian cavalry was watched from the heights above the river by Stepan Kozhukov, a junior artillery officer, who described the cavalry amassing in the area around the bridge where the Ukrainsky regiment and Kozhukov's battery on the hill had been ordered to block off their retreat. "Here they were stampeding, and all the time the confusion was getting worse. In a small space at the entrance of the Chorgun Ravine, where the dressing station was, were 4 Hussar and Cossack regiments all crammed together, and inside this mass, in isolated spots, one could make out the red tunics of the English, probably no less surprised than ourselves how unexpectedly this had happened. The enemy soon came to the conclusion that they had nothing to fear from the panic-stricken hussars and Cossacks, and, tired of slashing, decided to return the way they had come, through another cannonade of artillery and rifle fire. It is difficult, if not impossible, to do justice to the feat of these mad cavalry. Having lost at least a quarter of their number during the attack, and being apparently impervious to new dangers and losses, they quickly reformed their squadrons to return over the same ground, littered with their dead and dying. With desperate courage, these valiant lunatics set off again, and not one of the living, even the wounded, surrendered. It took a long time for the Hussars and Cossacks to collect themselves. They were convinced that the entire enemy cavalry were pursuing them, and angrily did not want to believe that they had been crushed by a relatively insignificant handful of daredevils. The Cossacks were the first to come to their senses, but they would not return to the battlefield. Instead, they set themselves the new tasks in hand, taking prisoners, killing the wounded as they lay on the ground, and rounding up the English horses to offer them for sale. As the Light Brigade rode back through the corridor of fire in the North Valley, Liprandi ordered the Polish lancers on the Causeway Heights to cut off their retreat. But the lancers had little stomach for a fight with the courageous Light Brigade, which they had just seen charge through the Russian guns and disperse the Cossacks in a panic flight, and the few attacks they made were against small groups of wounded men. Larger groups they left alone. When the retreating column of the 8th Hussars and 4th Regiment of Light Dragoons neared the Lancers, recalled Lord George Paget, the commander of the Light Dragoons, who had rallied them together before the retreat, "down the Lancers came upon us at a sort of trot. Then the Lancers stopped, halted is hardly the word, and evinced that same air of bewilderment, I know of no other word, that I had twice before remarked on this day. A few of the men on the right flank of their leading squadrons came into momentary collision with the right flank of our fellows, but beyond this they did nothing, and actually allowed us to shuffle, to edge away by them, at a distance of hardly a horse's length. Well, we got by them without, I believe, the loss of a single man, How, I know not. It is a mystery to me. And that force being composed of English ladies, I don't think one of us could have escaped. In fact, the English ladies were on the Sapoon Heights with all the other spectators who watched the remnants of the Light Brigade stagger back in ones and twos, many of them wounded from the charge. Among them was Fanny Dubley, who not only watched the scene in horror, but later on that afternoon rode out with her husband to get a closer look at the carnage on the battlefield. Past the scene of the morning we rode slowly. Round us were dead and dying horses, numberless, and near me lay a Russian soldier, very still upon his face. In a vineyard a little to my right, a Turkish soldier was also stretched out dead. The horses, mostly dead, were all unsaddled, and the attitudes of some betokened extreme pain, and then the wounded soldiers crawling to the hills. Of the 661 men who set off on the charge, 113 were killed, 134 wounded, and 45 were taken prisoner. 362 horses were lost or killed. The casualties were not much higher than those suffered on the Russian side, 180 killed and wounded, nearly all of them in the first two defensive lines, and far lower than the numbers reported in the British press. The Times reported that 800 cavalry had been engaged, of whom only 200 had returned. The Illustrated London News that only 163 had returned safely from the charge. From such reports, the story quickly spread of a tragic blunder, redeemed by heroic sacrifice, the myth set in stone by Alfred Tennyson's famous poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, published only 2 months after the event. Forward the Light Brigade. Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldiers knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. But contrary to the myth of a glorious disaster, the charge was in some ways a success despite the heavy casualties. The objective of a cavalry charge was to scatter the enemy's lines and frighten him off the battlefield, and in this respect, as the Russians acknowledged, the Light Brigade had achieved its aim. The real blunder of the British at Balaclava was not so much the charge of the Light Brigade as their failure to pursue the Russian cavalry once the Heavy Brigade had routed them and the Light Brigade had got them on the run, and then finish off the rest of Leprandi's army. The British blamed the Turks for their defeat at Balaclava, accusing them of cowardice for abandoning the redoubts. They also later claimed that they had looted property, not only from the British cavalry, but also from nearby settlements where they were said to have committed some cold-blooded cruelties upon the unfortunate villagers around Balaclava, cutting the throats of the men and stripping their cabins of everything. Lucan's Turkish interpreter, John Blunt, thought the accusations were unfair, and that, if any looting did take place, it was by the nondescript crowds of camp followers who prowled about the battlefield. The Turks were treated appallingly for the rest of the campaign. They were routinely beaten, cursed, spat upon, and jeered at by the British troops, who sometimes even used them to carry them with their bundles on their backs across the pools and quagmires of the Balaclava Road, according to Blunt. Seen by the British as little more than slaves, the Turkish troops were used for digging trenches or transporting heavy loads between Balaclava and the Sevastopol Heights. Because their religion forbade them from eating most of the available British army rations, they never received enough food. In desperation, some of them began to steal, for which they were flogged by their British masters well beyond the maximum of 45 lashes allowed for the Queen's own troops. Of the 4,000 Turkish soldiers who fought at Balaclava on the 25th of October, half would die from malnutrition by the end of 1854, and many of the rest would become too weak for active service. Yet the Turks behaved with dignity, and Blunt, for one, was much struck by the forbearing manner in which they endured their bad treatment and long suffering. Rustem Pasha, the Egyptian officer in charge of the Turkish troops at Balaclava, urged them to be patient and resigned, and not to forget that the English troops were the guests of their sultan and were fighting in defence of the integrity of the Ottoman Empire. The Russians celebrated Balaclava as a victory. The capture of the redoubts on the Causeway Heights was certainly a tactical success. The next day in Sevastopol, it was marked by an Orthodox service as the British guns were paraded through the town. The Russians now had a commanding position from which to attack the British supply lines between Balaclava and the Sevastopol Heights. The British were confined to their inner defence lines on the hills around Kardikoy. Russian soldiers paraded through Sevastopol with trophies from the battlefield, British overcoats, swords, tunics, shakos, boots and cavalry horses. The morale of the Sevastopol garrison was immediately lifted by the victory. For the first time since the defeat at the Alma, the Russians sensed that they were a match for the Allied armies on the open battlefield. The Tsar learned about the claimed victory in his palace at Gatchina on the 31st of October, when the morning courier arrived from Sevastopol. Anna Tyutcheva, who was with the Empress in the Arsenal halls listening to a Beethoven recital, wrote in her diary later on that day, "The news has lifted all our spirits. The Tsar, coming to the Empress to tell her the news, was so overcome with emotion that, in front of all of us, he threw himself onto his knees before the sacred icons and burst into tears. The Empress and her daughter, Maria Nikolaevna, thinking that the frightful disturbance of the Tsar signified the fall of Sevastopol, also went down on their knees, but he calmed them, told them all the joyous news, and at once ordered a service of thanksgiving prayers at which the whole court attended."